You're listening to From the Public Domain, stories and excerpts from the public domain. I'm your host, Susie Alphins. The Island of Cyprus by Charles Bertrand Lewis. Mr. and Mrs. Bowser had finished dinner and were seated in the back parlor when Mr. Bowser laid aside the paper he had been glancing over. Pitkins was in the office this afternoon, and the change in him was something amazing. Yes, replied Mrs. Bowser. I couldn't help but pity him, though I know he is all to blame. There's no doubt he drove Mrs. Pitkins into running away.
I think he did.
They say he was a regular domestic tyrant. He knew all and wouldn't acknowledge that she had common sense. If he gave her a dollar, he expected her to make it go as far as 10. And he was constantly taunting her that she was no housekeeper.
I've heard so, remarked Mrs. Bowser.
That's the way with some men, and I wonder that their wives stand it so long. By what right does a husband boss a wife? Matrimony is an equal partnership, as I understand it. The wife has all the rights of a husband, and in most cases, she is just as intelligent and possessed of just as good judgment. By what legal or moral right does a husband hand his wife a dollar for pin money, and then go out and squander 9 for his own selfish pleasures?
I don't know, admitted Mrs. Bowser, who was wishing the conversation had taken some other turn.
As a matter of fact and right, Mrs. Bowser, you have as much right to our money as I have. Half of it belongs to you. Instead of coaxing and begging for money, you should demand it.
Yes?
Very doubtfully. I know men, continued Mr. Bowser, as he warmed up to his subject, who are jealous of their wives' intelligence, and who sit down on them at every opportunity. Thank heaven, I am not of that sort. I have always been proud and pleased at your general knowledge of things. The fact that you are about as well posted as I am makes me proud.
Does it? Asked Mrs. Bowser, with a blush and a smile.
Of course it does. I sometimes find that you are a bit ahead of me on things, and that pleases me the more. If I can learn anything from you, I shall be glad of it.
Won't you get mad if I tell you where you were wrong in talking to Mr. Abner last evening about the Chinese?
No, of course not. If I am in the wrong, I want to be set right. What was it?
You said the war between China and Japan was caused by a dispute over the island of Cyprus.
Yes, and I didn't say it without knowing what I was talking about.
The trouble arose over Korea, my dear. The island of Cyprus is in the Mediterranean Sea, thousands of miles away, while Korea is...
Mrs. Bowser, do you suppose I've lived for 49 years without knowing where the island of Cyprus is? Interrupted Mr. Bowser as he flushed up.
You know, of course, and it was probably a slip of the tongue when you said that the Japanese and Chinese got into a dispute over it.
Never. There was no slip about it. I am not in the habit of making slips when talking history. The dispute began over the island of Cyprus.
Don't you remember when Turkey ceded that island to England?
No, ma'am, I don't. Nor does anyone else. The dispute began over Cyprus, and Korea had nothing to do with it. The idea of your trying to post me on current events strikes me as rather cheeky.
But right here in the paper, Mr. Bowser, is news from Korea in connection with the war.
I can't help what is in the paper. That's the way with you and all other wives. Let a husband admit that you know a tenth of what he does, and you try to make him out a numbskull. It was Cyprus, of course. The idea of your standing up and making me out an idiot.
You know where Korea is, of course? Queried Mrs. Bowser after a long silence, during which Mr. Bowser's face took on a deeper red and his breathing became more labored.
Are you talking to me? He demanded, as he stood up and extended his arm and pointed his finger full at her. Do I know where my own house is? Have I got brains enough to drop off a streetcar?
Have I ever been sent to an idiot asylum? Mrs. Bowser made no reply. She realized her great mistake and regretted it, but it was too late.
When a wife thinks she knows as much as her husband, when she even thinks she knows more, things are getting ready for a calamity. She should know her place, and her husband should see that she keeps it. The next thing, you'll be getting up and talking about your legal rights.
You said you were proud and pleased at my knowledge of things, put in Mrs. Bowser as he stamped around the room.
And because I admitted that you might possibly have the horse sense to know that both ends of a streetcar stopped at the same time, you presume to correct me about the island of Cyprus. Didn't I say that was the way of all wives? I can see now what sort of a life poor Pitkins must have led, and what a glad relief it was when he found she had run away. Look around you, Mrs. Bowser, and see what sort of a house this is. If you'd pay some attention to our home instead of having your nose stuck into a newspaper, we might take some little comfort.
I'd like to see one kept in better order, returned Mrs. Bowser, with a show of spirit.
But don't sass me back. When a wife begins to sass back, her husband should get his eyes open. I did intend to hand you out a $10 bill this evening and tell you to go down and use it as you liked, but now I shan't do it. It would simply be throwing money away. I came home this evening prepared to sit down and enjoy my fireside, and you see how I have been disappointed. It was with the kindest feelings that I frankly admitted that you might possibly know cornstalks from cabbages, and you repaid me by trying to make out that I ought to be led around by a guardian for fear I'd fall into the sewer. They talk about the hundreds of divorces coming up in the courts every term. The only wonder is that there are not thousands and tens of thousands, that there is a husband left in the land who can put up with these things.
All I said was that it was Korea and not Cyprus, quietly observed Mrs. Bowser.
But I say it was Cyprus, shouted Mr. Bowser. Don't I know? Isn't it my business to know? Would I be idiot enough to say Cyprus if it wasn't Cyprus? Can any human being on the face of this earth imagine a wife knowing more than her husband about any subject more serious than whooping cough and nursing bottles? Mrs. Bowser, you have brought it on your own head. You have finally loaded the last hair on the camel's back. Our lawyers will get together tomorrow and arrange matters. And if you don't want to go to Texas, you can go to Korea. I'm going to bed. If our child wakes up, kiss him for me and tell him his father will always love and cherish him, but that he had a dignity to maintain and was driven to maintain it at the sacrifice of his home and happiness.
The Last Straw by Maria Louise Poole. From Tenting at Stony Beach. Randy Rankin always sits straight. She never lulls. As she sat there in the most uncomfortable chair in the tent, she was a great contrast to us, who came to the shore with intent to do nothing but lounge, and who appeared to be accomplishing our intentions. I am sure there are some people who are never comfortable save when they are uncomfortable. As I reclined on our couch and looked at Mrs. Rankin, I could but wonder if Mr. Rankin also always wanted to sit straight. If he did not, I thought I had a clue as to why he should now live by himself in that old schoolhouse, while she should dwell in the 2 mile. This woman is considerably above the average native on these shores. It was interesting to have her spend part of a day with us, but I could not put from me the feeling that she might be somewhat overwhelming as a constant companion. I noticed one peculiarity about her speech. She would frequently speak correctly for several consecutive sentences, and then would lapse with apparent hopelessness into a tangle of subjects and predicates. I decided that she knew how to use the simple laws of grammar, but that the custom and example of years were generally more powerful than any other consideration. At our request, she had taken off her things, which were a black-fringed silk shawl and a sunbonnet. A pair of large drab cotton gloves had also been removed and were pulled into each other in the form of a ball and placed in the sunbonnet. Her dress was black alpaca, which was so shiny as to look new. Of course it was not wrinkled, for alpaca cannot wrinkle. Although the cloth looked so new, I felt that this appearance was deceptive, for I was sure that not within 30 years at the very least could any dressmaker have been persuaded to cut a bodice like that. Perhaps I may as well state here that later I was informed by Mrs. Marlowe that the dress was new, had never been worn before, and was cut and made by Mrs. Rankin herself. It was of that fashion once known as the fan waist. Those who have seen this style will know what I mean, and to those who have not, I can give no description which would be sufficiently graphic. It was cut down in the neck so that a slight hint of the collarbone could be seen, and round this neck was fulled on a strip of that Hamburg edging which is brought round in packs by Jew peddlers. She wore a white apron with three tucks at the bottom and finished off with more edging. Now, if you think Randy Rankin, in spite of her face and dress, was one for whom you could feel anything like pity or condescension, you are entirely mistaken. There was a grimness, a decision, and a strength about her, a shrewdness and sense that made it impossible not to have a sort of respect for her. If she chose to dress as she did when she was young, you could only be amused. The conviction that she would not care if you went into convulsions of laughter at her made the convulsions impossible. She was in the habit of relating some of the infelicities of her married life with the matter-of-fact calmness with which any of the fishermen here might tell of a poor haul at certain seasons. A poor haul was unfortunate, but it was a subject which could be fully discussed without any delicacy. I have said that my walking across the floor of the tent with slippers, whose heels clacked at every step, excited in her collar reminiscences of her married life. "It ain't no secret why Mr. Rankin and me can't live together," she said, as she slowly drank her lemonade. "I never did believe in mysteries, and when folks want to know the trouble, I'm always willing to tell 'em. Mr. Rankin was so easygoin' that I guess he could have put up with me, or anybody, till the judgment day. But my nerves can't bear everything. There were two things that decided me." Mrs. Rankin here spoke with extraordinary decision. "One was them down-to-the-heel slippers. I dunno where he fished 'em up from, under the eaves somewhere, I expect. At any rate, he come into the kitchen one morning with them on. He wa'n't very well that day, and he stayed in the house and kept walking up and down, clack, 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 across that oilcloth, until I felt that I should fly. I can bear some things well enough, but some things I can't. And Mr. Rankin, one way and another, had got to be awful trying. My teeth were on edge most of the time. I said to him, 'Hadn't you better put on them list slippers o' yourn?' I went and got 'em, and put 'em down in front of him. He didn't say he wouldn't put 'em on, that wa'n't his way. But all the same, he didn't do it, but kept on them things, and kept walking and clacking all that day. He went well for a week. And the whole of that mortal time, he wore them slippers, with heels that had busted off the uppers, just far enough to let him down good with every step. I suppose you know there's always a last straw. I concluded that I had about reached that straw, and I told Mr. Rankin so. He coughed, and said he guessed not. He guessed things would go on with us about as usual. Will you believe it? All the rest of the time I lived with him, about 6 months, he would never wear any other slippers but them. I had given the matter the most earnest thought of which I was capable. I was fearful unhappy, and growing more so every day. The man's whole nature rasped on mine so that I was sometimes afraid of myself when I saw him coming. And yet, he was an upright, honest man. I have nothing to say against his character. He must have had his trials with me. Luckily for him, he had a thick skin." Mrs. Rankin paused and seemed to be looking into the past. After a moment, she resumed. "But lor', 'tain't no use whining. Jonas Rankin's just what he is, and I'm just what I be. I had made a firm resolution that them slippers, even if he wore 'em so long as I lived, shouldn't be the last straw. but I told him fair and square that the very next thing would be. I'd got to the end of my rope. He laughed. I guess that laugh of his has made me as mad as I ever want to be. I used to pray over things. My health won't first rate, and I've noticed prayer seems to do more good when you're kind of sound bodily. No, don't give me more lemonade. Well, what do you think that man did next? Randy waited for us to guess, but naturally, we did not fully know the capabilities of Mr. Jonas Rankin, and so could make no guess at all. The tree of death was the next thing, she said, with such an intensity of utterance that we stopped the laugh that rose to our lips and waited with what patience we might. Yes, she went on, it belonged to his first wife, she that was a Lincoln, and he said they used to have it in their parlor. This he told me when we were first married. He gave it to his son, who lives under the first cliff on the shore, you know. One day, Mr. Rankin come in with a large flat parcel under his arm. He took off the wrappings and said he guessed we'd have that in the sitting room now. Then he hung up the thing in a place where you'd see it, and nothing else if you were anywhere in the room. I begged him not to have it there. There was nothing in the world I hated so much. Did you ever see one? No, we never had seen one. It's a tall, black, dead-looking tree, with a horrible picture of the devil tramping about the roots with a watering pot, from which great streams of water are running. The devil has cloven feet, horns, and a tail with a prong to it. He is grinning, because the tree is so flourishing. For fruit, there are great black balls, and in each ball is printed the name of some sin, such as lying, theft, lust, covetousness, and other sins which I need not mention. This picture was in a frame of wood painted a light blue, with gilt sprigs on it. What do you think? That man was bound to have the picture hung there. He said the sight of it was wholesome for frivolous souls. I told him that if we had ever been frivolous, it had all been taken out of us long ago. He said he guessed it had better hang there, and I knew it was settled. I found out afterward that John's little girl, John is Mr. Rankin's son, had had fits just from looking at the tree of death. I could believe that well enough, for the child was a nervous, fanciful thing. She was frightened almost out of her senses. She couldn't keep away from the picture either, and used to steal into the room where it was and stand and look at it. Finally, her mother found it out. Lily threw herself into her mother's arms one day and said that the devil was watering the sins in her heart, and soon they would be as big as those black balls. Then she had a kind of convulsion. That picture came down double quick. The doctor said that child would be crazy if she were left to have such notions. Do you think I was going to have that blasted thing there for me to stare at? No, that was the last straw. I told Mr. Rankin it was the last straw. I wa'n't a-going to keep house for him no more. He tried to argue the point. I told him he might save his breath. The house happened to be mine. I told him he might take his traps and go. He had just about enough interest money to get his victuals and clothes if he lived by himself. Just keep your interest, says I. You just row your own boat, and I'll row mine. I guess there wa'n't no love lost between us. He took his things, or rather his first wife's things, and went and bought an old schoolhouse that the town ain't had no use for this dozen years. He paid $50 for it. He's lived there ever since, be 7 years next spring. I do some washing and some slop work, and pick some huckleberries. I get along. I ain't got no tree of death in my house, nor nobody that wears slippers that click on the oilcloth. I do Mr. Rankin's washing and mending, but I don't charge him nothing for it. I send the clothes back by the baker every fortnight, and the grocery man brings 'em. I don't see Mr. Rankin from year's end to year's end, and I don't want to. His son and I are on good terms. John is a good fellow. I like him. And naturally, there's great sympathy between his family and me on the subject of that picture. John's wife has been so far as to say that she didn't blame no woman for not living with no man who wanted to put the tree of death under her nose all the time. Of course, I'm lonesome once in a while. I often think, if my son had lived, 'twould have been different. Mrs. Rankin became silent. Her deep-set eyes seemed to look more sunken than ever. She roused herself.
Oh, yes, she said. I get along.
The Awful Fate of Mr. Wolf by Joel Chandler Harris. From Uncle Remus, His Songs and His Sayings. Uncle Remus was half-soling one of his shoes, and his Miss Sally's little boy had been handling his awls, his hammers, and his knives to such an extent that the old man was compelled to assume a threatening attitude. But peace reigned again, and the little boy perched himself on a chair, watching Uncle Remus driving in pigs.
Folks what's allers pesterin' people, and botherin' longer dat what ain't darin', don't never come to no good end. Dere was Br'er Wolf, stid er mindin' his own business. He had er take and go in partnerships wid Br'er Fox, and dey wa'n't scarcely a minute in de day dat he wa'n't at a Br'er Rabbit. And he kept on and kept on twel fust news you knowed. He got caught up wid, and he got caught up monstrous bad.
Goodness, Uncle Remus, I thought the wolf let the rabbit alone after he tried to fool him about the fox being dead.
Better let me tell dish year my way. By and by, it'll be your bedtime, and Miss Sally'll be a-hollerin' out of you, and you'll be a-wimplin' round, and then Mars John'll fetch up dere wid dat air strop what I made for him.
The child laughed and playfully shook his fist in the simple, serious face of the venerable old darky, but said no more. Uncle Remus waited a while to be sure there was to be no other demonstration, and then proceeded.
Br'er Rabbit ain't seen no peace whatsoever. He can't leave home, except Br'er Wolf would make a raid and tote off some of the family. Br'er Rabbit built him a straw house, and it was tore down. Then he made a house out in pine tops, and dat went the same way. Then he made him a bark house, and dat was raided on. And every time he lost a house, he lost one of his children's. Last Br'er Rabbit got mad, he did, and cussed, and then he went off, he did, and got some carpenters, and they built him a plank house with rock foundations. After that, he could have some peace and quietness. He could go out and pass the time of a day with his neighbors, and come back and sit by the fire and smoke his pipe and read the newspaper, same like any man what got a family. He made a hole, he did, in the cellar, where the little rabbits could hide out when dar was much of a racket in the neighborhood, and the latch on the front door caught on the inside. Br'er Wolf, he see how the land lay, he did, and he lay low. The little rabbits was mighty skittish, but it got so that cold chills ain't run up Br'er Rabbit's back no more when he heard Br'er Wolf go galloping by. By and by, one day when Br'er Rabbit was fixin' for to call on Miss Coon, he heard a monster's fussin' clatter up the big road. And most before he could fix his ears for to listen, Br'er Wolf run in the door. The little rabbits, they went into their hole in the cellar, they did, like blown out a candle. Br'er Wolf was fairly covered with mud and mighty nigh out of wind. Oh, do pray save me, Br'er Rabbit, says Br'er Wolf, says he. Do, please, Br'er Rabbit, the dogs atter me. And they'll tar me up. Don't you hear 'em coming? Oh, do please save me, Br'er Rabbit. Hide me somewheres where the dogs won't get me. No quicker said than done. Jump in dat big chist dar, Br'er Wolf, says Br'er Rabbit, says he. Jump in there and make yourself at home. In jump Br'er Wolf. Down come the lid. And into the hasp went the hook. And there Mr. Wolf was. Then Br'er Rabbit went to the looking glass, he did, and winked at hisself. And then he drawed the rocking chair in front of the fire, he did, and took a big chaw tobacco.
Tobacco, Uncle Remus?
asked the little boy incredulously.
Rabbit tobacco, honey. You know, dis your life everlasting. What Miss Sally puts among the clothes in de trunk. Well, that's rabbit tobacco. Den, Brer Rabbit sat dar long time, he did, turning his mind over and working his thinking machine. By and by, he got up and sort of stir round. Den Brer Wolf open up. Is de dogs all gone, Brer Rabbit? Seem like I hear one and smelling round de chimney corner dis now. Den Brer Rabbit get de kettle and fill it full of water and put it on de fire. What you doing now, Brer Rabbit? I'm fixin' for to make you a nice cup of tea, Brer Wolf. Den Brer Rabbit went to de cupboard and get de gimlet and commence for to bore little holes in de chist lid. What you doing now, Brer Rabbit? I'm a boring little holes so you can get breath, Brer Wolf. Den Brer Rabbit went out and get some more wood and fling it on de fire. What you doing now, Brer Rabbit? I'm a chunking up de fire so you won't get cold, Brer Wolf. Den Brer Rabbit went down into de cellar and fotch out all his chillens. What you doing now, Brer Rabbit? I'm a-tellin' my chillens what a nice man you is, Brer Wolf. And the chillens, they had to put their hands on their mouths for to keep from laughing. Den Brer Rabbit, he got the kettle and commenced for to pour the hot water on the chist lid. What that I hear, Brer Rabbit? You hear the wind a-blowin', Brer Wolf. Den the water begin for to sift through. What dat I feel, Brer Rabbit? You feels de fleas biting, Brer Wolf. Dey are biting mighty hard, Brer Rabbit. Turn over on de other side, Brer Wolf. What dat I feel now, Brer Rabbit? Still, you feels de fleas, Brer Wolf. Dey are eating me up, Brer Rabbit. And dem was de last words of Brer Wolf. Casey's scalding water done de business. Den Brer Rabbit call in his neighbors, he did, and dey hilt a regular jubilee. And if you go to Brer Rabbit's house right now, I don't know, but what you'll find Brer Wolf's hide hanging in de back porch, and all because he was so busy with other folks' doings.
You've been listening to From the Public Domain. I'm your host, Susie Elthens.